Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to episode 13 of The High Low, a weekly news and pop culture podcast hosted by writers Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton. We are now in the freaky 13th week. Dolly, are you superstitious?
Yeah, horribly so. Horribly so. But I think people that are superstitious are just people that are secret control freaks. So I think if I do like a little ditty to a certain amount of magpies every time I see them, then something brilliant will happen that day.
My mum is ridiculously superstitious to the point where if we have 13 people for lunch or for dinner, there's a teddy sitting in a 14, and we always have to say hello Mrs. Magpie, hello Mr. Magpie.
Yeah, we have to
under ladders, over ladders, under ladders.
Yeah, my mum will like sprint across rooms and squeal and like scream to take new pairs of shoes off tables. She's completely insane with it.
The shoe one's quite a common one, though.
It depends. If you're in America,
that's just because they're anal. It's not superstition. So apologies in advance for the not-so-great recording today. Unfortunately, there is some heavy building work going on outside the studio.
And apparently, they don't want to be told that we're recording a pop culture podcast.
You know, we've offered them Dolly's tits. They weren't interested. I'm joking. We haven't. But we would if it meant that you could have a good record.
Yeah. This is what we'll do for you. So, yes, there'll be a bit of clattering in the background.
But please bear with us. We missed a week last week. We had a week off, as some of you will have noticed. In that time, sadly, again, there has been a horrible and vile terror attack. So our thoughts and prayers are with everyone affected by the attacks in London Bridge. May we hope that this doesn't become a leitmotif for the podcast, that we begin each one by offering thoughts and prayers. It's a really, really horrible situation. So, yeah, just thinking of everyone that has been affected, all the victims and the victims' families.
By the time you listen to this podcast, we will all know who our Prime Minister is. So we've decided...
Weird that, isn't it? I was on the tube this morning and everyone was looking really mellow and I was like, oh, I don't know. I sort of thought there'd be like a GE 2017 vibe.
Did you vote this morning?
No, I haven't gone yet. I'm going to go after this.
I voted this morning, and because I've found... I'm not being cynical. I do think it's great that so many people are like, vote, it's important to vote. But I do
think I'm not being cynical. I do understand that people have to vote.
No. But I have really noticed this time, and quite right so, because, you know, it is an important election, but I have noticed people being really like, I'm going to vote.
Oh, purposeful.
I'm the best. And so this morning...
Shouty voters.
I took a photo of me outside the polling station with like a really goofy smile, being like, I voted, give me a cookie. So yeah, by the time you listen to this, we'll know who our Prime Minister is. So we're not going to be those sorts of podcasters who are going to bleat on and on about how important it is to go and vote.
Because if you haven't voted, you won't have
voted.
It's
too late anyway. Yeah, and we aren't going to speculate about what the outcome will be, because you'll already know. And we probably know that the result will be the most predictable outcome anyway. So we thought we would... give you some facts to cheer us all up, which is, we thought we'd talk about some of the best UK political parties that have ever existed. So I did some light reading last night. First of all, there's the Church of the Militant Elvis Party.
The Militant Elvis Party?
Yeah, which bizarrely is still in existence. The leader of the party is David Bishop, who also goes by the nicknames of Lord Biro and the Bus Pass Elvis. The party is concerned with the depletion of the Amazon rainforest, climate change, all very valid, and the power of Tesco on the British High Street.
Hold on. So I thought it would be like something to do with the memory of Elvis.
Nothing to do with Elvis, no.
Right, okay.
And then there was the Miss Great Britain Party, sadly, no longer with us, founded in 2018, whose candidates were mostly women who had entered the Miss Great Britain beauty contest. And a part of me was like, oh, that's really brilliant.
Only some of them.
But it's, I thought, oh, that's brilliant. It's about getting, you know, maybe people who wouldn't be as politically engaged. Yeah. And it's about, you know, challenging the way that we stereotype people. But the party claimed that its main purpose was to make Westminster sexy and not sleazy.
I think that's perfectly valid.
So that was deregistered a year after its conception. Also now defunct, but staggeringly still on the register of political parties, is the Fancy Dress Party, formed in 1979 as a frivolous alternative to the mainstream electoral parties. I love the sound of the people who created this party. Their most famous policy was to use a smaller font size to automatically reduce unemployment statistics. I love it. Keynote policies include cutting police paperwork in making your own doily classes, rapidly building new schools using revolutionary inflatable classrooms, making it easier for delinquent pupils to let the entire school down.
It's just, is that a pun?
It's just puns. It's just punners. Their entire manifesto is just puns.
I thought the manifesto might into. Be everyone had to cha-cha-cha into work. And the one that really defines for me my childhood was the Monster Raving Loony Party.
Oh,
I just
yes,
always
yeah.
remember that being a really big one. And well, this Jimmy was the Goldsmith's referendum party.
That was the precursor, apparently, the Fancy Dress Party to the Monster Raving
Loony
yeah,
Party.
Yeah. I want to talk about Wagamama with you.
Love Wagamama.
And I've wanted to, this has been building for quite some time, so I wanted to wait for it to get to a pinnacle. So I have rediscovered Wagamama mm-hmm. in the last 6 months in a way that is tantamount to unhealthy, I think. So I would say I'm there for a full meal twice a week.
On your own?
Sometimes on my own.
My mum would be so
sometimes
jealous.
With a flatmate. Does she love Wagamama?
Yeah, yeah. When she goes, she says, I'm coming up to London, let's go out for dinner. And I'm like, shall I meet you in High Street, Ken, on a long bench in Wagamama? That's her absolute dream.
And the problem is, your mother and I should have
I
more
do love
dinners
Wagamama.
Together. Because people are so snobby about Wagamama.
And really?
Yes, they are. Yeah. Yeah, the only person who'll go with me is India, and India and I go every single weekend now. I went to the Wagamama in Hampstead, and it was after I'd had like 2 hours sleep, and I'd been working all through the night, and I just kept thinking.
And eating apples as well.
The Wagamama just, yeah, my last week when I was on this huge deadline.
Dolly's eating list, rather than shopping list, was the most extraordinary thing that Ollie and I have ever read. It was like a whole packet of corn sausages, fine, we all like a meat feast or a non-meat feast, but then five apples, and Ollie was like so worried about the acid.
He was worried about my acidity.
He was really yeah. worried about your acidity, and Dolly tried to type that she'd had them all in an hour, so she basically had an apple every 10 minutes, but instead she just wrote, I had an apple every 10 minutes.
Do you know what, it was a dark week that
week.
That
was an interesting mental picture, Dolly. Apples and minges.
It was
live,
a dark
live
week. Do you know why? It's because I just couldn't. I didn't want to leave the house, and so I was like, I need to eat some green and some roughage, but I don't.
Apples
want to
aren't
go.
Roughage.
Oh God!
Now I tell you.
Anyway, so my thing in my head, I was like, this will be my big treat. Will be to go to Wagamama. Went to yeah. Wagamama. Routine maintenance in Hampstead. All very tragic. So I decided to walk like 3 miles to the next Wagamama. Then I got there. Do you know what they've taken off the menu? Carré Lomen.
Oh.
That's it. No. Okay. So that's a big story.
I always get like
we'll leave it to Charlie to decide, our producer, which
Carrie
is
Lomen
the most.
Carrie Lomen sounds like a 70s Hollywood actress.
Carrie Lomen was like it's like a lemongrass soup.
Oh, right. Is
anyway,
that what you get?
God, the TV so cool. and film rights are still available for that story. Charlie can decide which bits are the most interesting. So that's been my week.
I just read a brilliant book, which I will pop onto my Goodreads shelf. Do you know what I realised, by the way? We've got so many people friending us on Goodreads, which is amazing. I've got no idea what that entails. Perhaps it means that you now have access to my whole phone. I've just been like blindly accepting everyone. But I realised that on Goodreads, the best thing about it is that you can leave a star, how many stars?
Oh, cool.
And a review, which means we currently have about 135 stars and reviews to write, because all we've done
yeah,
is list.
Yeah, all we've listed.
We haven't actually used Goodreads to its magnificent ability.
And just so you know, we still have people asking us about the username for that. We are the High Low Show on Goodreads.
It's literally as simple as that. Anyway, I just read a book called The Awkward Age by Francesca Segal. It was shortlisted for the Costa Book Prize or whatever it's called, which is actually really
It's prestigious.
Yeah, yeah, I know, it's funny, isn't it? Because Costa Coffee is disgusting. So The Awkward Age by Francesca Segal, I really want you to read that. And I'm reading a great book of short stories, which you know are my faves, called The Dinner Party. Very cynical, very sad, but really, really good.
Who's that by?
Joshua Ferris.
I've got a copy of it. Yeah,
have you?
Yeah, I'll read that.
I'm also really psyched because not only is House of Cards back, but Orange is the New Black is back tomorrow.
Never watched an episode.
You would really like it. It's so feminist.
Okay. I get so obsessive. I'm quite tentative about standing on the edge of a box set. I was about to start watching Mad Men and I just thought, no, that will
no,
be
you'll
the summer
love,
gone.
Or, you'll love Orange is the New Black.
Okay.
You'll love it.
I'll give it a whirl. Sophie Wilkinson's obsessed
you'll love
with it.
On the low end of the high-lows cultural consumption, Ollie and I went to see Baywatch.
So what did you mean by that? As in, has there been a remake?
Yeah, there's a film out, doll.
Who with?
The Rock.
Who else?
Zac Efron, who genuinely looks like he's had Kendall surgery.
Who's Pamiandi?
Pamiandi is this like gorgeous blonde girl called Kelly Rohrbach, who has been doing the necessary rounds in GQ, Esquire, right, etc. But the funny thing is,
and how
that
funny her predecessor is now like
Pamiandi
does
Julian Assange. She does it. She has an appearance.
Does she?
Yeah, she just shakes her mane around in slow-mo. It's amazing. But they do the slow-mo and everyone else is in normal-mo.
So how was the film?
Like, so do you know what? At the beginning, I thought, oh my God, this is the worst film I've ever seen. But then I realised it knows it's terrible.
Right.
And it's so happy to be terrible that you're then happy.
So it's kind of self-awareness.
I mean, yes. I wouldn't say it needed to be a murder mystery crime thriller.
Jesus Christ, I'm not going to.
But it was quite. It was
that,
quite funny.
Think.
So that was at the low end, and something I've been watching that I want you to watch is Paula, starring Denise Goff on BBC Two. It's a three-parter. Denise Goff and Tom Hughes. We've had two so far. The third is last night. Depending on when you're listening to this, the third is on Thursday. It is absolutely brilliant. It's like the BBC at its best. It's like, you know, if you love any of those. It's just really creepy. It's about a woman called Paula who gets entangled with a man who proves to be more and more dangerous, played by Tom Hughes. It's brilliant.
Oh, God. Do you know why I don't like those?
Why?
I think that I'm prime for a sort of dastardly figure to take me for a ride.
You're prime for a Paula?
Yeah, as in I always... It's the same when you listen to The Archers and there's like a woman who likes a man fools.
Well,
I'm just worried that's my fate. Like Willoughby in Sense and Sensibility.
Well, Paula's a chemistry teacher. You're not, so we're off to a strong start.
Okay, fine, I can watch it. I've got another book that I want you to read, desperately want you to read. It's by Lynn Barber, who's one of our favourite journalists. She's an interviewer for the Sunday Times, and she is, I think, the best interviewer alive.
Yeah, she's very, very good.
I learnt through her Desert Island Discs, which is my favourite ever episode of Desert Island Discs.
Punchy,
ever.
Given that it's your like absolute number one.
I think it's the perfect formula. Anyway, she says in it that she wrote a book when she was 28 called How to Improve Your Man in Bed.
God, was she Dolly Alderton?
So I was desperate, obviously, exactly. I was like, oh, that's interesting she wrote that at my age. I think she was just married. I was really interested in tracking it down, and it's really hard to find. And I finally found a copy. And I'm going to read you a tiny bit of it, not because I'm not dredging out Lynn Barber's past and saying, oh, isn't it hilarious that she wrote this stuff, because I would hate for someone to do that when I'm older, because, you know, guff that I've written. But this, I think it's more a sign of the times, a sign of the 70s, which I just love. So there's a checklist at the back that says a few more suggestions for improving your sex life. Keep fit, get slim, have a hairdo, buy a waterbed, invite a girl to join you, read a dirty book, use nasty four-letter words when you're making love, buy a vibrator, take the pill, think sexy thoughts, change the sheets regularly. There's something here about a waterbed.
What, the sheets on the waterbed?
Plait flowers in your pubic hair.
Plait flowers in your pubic hair?
This is my bit.
What, whilst also using the vibrator? That would be a
I think
travesty.
It's more like you do it in preparation. Tease him and play the tart. Hide the Tampax.
She's got plenty in common with Gilly Cooper. Gilly Cooper could have written this.
Invest in a bidet.
What, to keep
rouge your nipples, buy a frothy negligee or an Arab caftan.
Have you Instagrammed this?
Yes.
Please Instagram rouge your nipples. That's my rouge
it's
your
so
nipples
funny.
And plait flowers into your pubic hair. How big are these flowers? I mean, it was the 70s. Bushes were probably gyno. But
do you know what?
Are we talking sunflowers?
I had. I was thinking that. I think it might be more maybe like petals. I'm very aware that I don't want it to seem like I'm taking the piss out of her, because I think it's not really...
Look, if anyone can take it, Lynn Barber can.
Well, I think what's so funny is that it's definitely...
Yeah, it's a sign of the time.
It's an insight into young suburban sexuality in the 70s.
But have you ever read any of Jilly Cooper's column in the 70s for a newspaper as a newly married housewife?
Yes, I have. Oh,
that's what I mean. They're very different beasts now. But yeah. Back then, I think they sound quite similar. Yeah. Have you also been watching The Handmaid's Tale?
Oh, yeah, addicted.
It's absolutely brilliant. And if you haven't watched it, I'm ashamed to say I never read Margaret Atwood's book. I think it came out in 1985. I have ordered it. I don't know how it passed me by. I did English literature. It's awful. I haven't read it. Anyway.
I'm ashamed I haven't read it either.
Well, I think we must both read
it. Yeah, we should.
I thought it was about, because I'd always heard that it had a lot in common with Chaucer, and I was so bored of studying Chaucer and his bloody detachable genitals. There was always stories of women carrying like baskets of dicks and men like stealing detachable vaginas, and obviously it always had like sexual commentary or political or cultural commentary, and I was like, I can't be bothered with any more mobile genitals.
Chaucerian
bollocks. But it's so scary, because it's about, for anyone that hasn't seen it, we're not giving anything away, but it's about a dystopian society where it's sort of neo-Christian cult where women,
it's based on the Old Testament,
where women don't have any rights.
Yes,
baby makers. And Elizabeth, what's she called, that actress? She was in Mad Men. Elizabeth Moss.
Thank you, Charlie.
Elizabeth Moss is amazing in it. And Alexis Bledel, you know, she was in Gilmore Girls.
It's the reason it feels
so... And Joseph Fiennes. There's loads of great people in it.
It feels so timely at the moment. A lot of people are actually saying, Marianne Keyes was tweeting, saying, I actually can't watch this right now when you think about policies being passed in Trump's America, because it's all about control of women's bodies and policing of women's bodies. Basically, that's what it's about. It's beautifully made, and yeah, I think every woman should be watching it.
I literally, if it was on Netflix, I would have cancelled this podcast to watch it. I absolutely would have. Sorry, sponsors. I'd also like to extend congratulations this week to George and Amal Clooney on the birth of their twins. I believe they're called Alexander and Ella, but I may have made up the girl's name. I'm only sure of the boys. But what I really enjoyed is that his dad did an interview. I don't know who with, but he did it via telephone, and it's kind of gone all over various news outlets. And I listened to him saying, George is going to be a fantastic father, Amal's going to be a fantastic mother. She already is actually a fantastic mother. George has certainly married up.
Aww.
How great is that? We're so used to her being subjugated as a human rights lawyer.
Yes.
As his like beaut but side piece.
Yeah.
And I love I love him being like, actually, he's the lucky one in this scenario.
And he is.
Yeah,
and also, when you, again, I'm going to bleat on about it, his Desert Island Discs, he talks about...
I haven't listened to that one.
It's incredible.
What year?
And he talks about, it was in the 90s,
okay,
and Sue Lawley practically throws a knickers at him. He keeps calling him George after every sentence. But he talks about his father, and I didn't realise that his father is a very politically active man, and they have their relationship...
He's quite hunky. I've seen a picture of him.
Their relationship is entirely founded on activism and campaigning and speaking out, and it sounds like both of them are really upstanding men, I think.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Now it's time for the top line, presented this week by Dolly Alderton.
I like that we've changed this into a bit of a game show segment.
For those of you unfamiliar, the top line is a 90-second segment where Dolly or I race to tell you 10 pieces of bite-sized news from around the world.
Naomi Alderman has won the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction for her feminist sci-fi novel, The Power. It is her fourth book that explores themes of power, violence and gender. Lauren Child, children's author and the new children's laureate, has voiced concerns that boys don't like reading books that have girls as the main characters, and that makes it harder for girls to be equal. McDonald's have teamed up with cult Japanese retailer Beams to create a line of t-shirts, bags, phone cases and hats. To celebrate this collaboration, McDonald's will also be selling 300 jars of its Big Mac sauce. The Sun has reported that Ariana Grande and her team got bee tattoos after the One Love concert backstage by Manchester Inc. as a tribute to the city and those involved in the recent terror attack, as the bee has long been a symbol of Manchester and its industrial past. A surfer said he fought with a small shark after being bitten off Bantam Beach in South Devon. Mr. Thompson said the shark, estimated about 3 foot long, grabbed him on the leg and his hand was cut to pieces. The Women's Equality Party has received an overwhelming number of terrifyingly aggressive threats over the past week, with one of its candidates, Nimco Ali, being sent a letter of racist abuse signed Joe Cox after the Labour Party MP was murdered near her constituency office last summer. A Luton maths teacher who allowed pupils to settle disputes during out-of-hours wrestling sessions, which he charged £20 for, has been banned from teaching. Bumble, the female-led dating app, is launching its first pop-up bar called The Hive in New York, where you can meet your matches in real life. Lord Sugar, in response to Corbyn supporters accusing him of encouraging people not to vote Labour so he can pay less tax, has posted a photo of a cheque he paid in tax this January for over £58 million. A harassment investigation as taxi app company Uber has led to more than 20 staff being fired. The sackings related to sexual harassment, bullying and issues about poor company culture were sparked after a former employee published her experience of working there in a blog post condemning their treatment of women.
I read that post, did you?
Yeah, I did as well. Yeah, I'm glad that they followed that up. I'm glad women aren't being ignored anymore when, you know, I'm glad that that was...
God, I think that, yeah, I think there were a million stories written from a million. I think it's really easy for startups like Uber and Facebook and YouTube and, you know, a lot of these for people to be like, oh my God, there are all these horror stories. There are, but I think in any gigantic company that's doing something pioneering, there are horror stories. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it's limited to Uber and Facebook. I think you could probably find it in so many companies.
But I just think it's so important that, you know, woman has had the bravery to speak out.
What I mean is I just don't think she's alone. I just think
I agree.
I think she had a platform to put it there.
I agree. And also that she, because a lot of people would think, and I understand that, I'm not going to go through all this hell, probably not to be believed by anyone, for it to be followed up. So this is a great story of triumph.
I love that Ariana Grande and her team got bee tattoos after the One Love concert. I mean, what a month it's been for them. And also, I really enjoyed that. I know it's obviously really bad, but I really enjoyed the Luton maths teacher charging £20 for wrestling matches between pupils.
I know.
How did he think that was going to end?
I know. Also, how did those teachers ever think that those kids are the biggest blabbermouths, aren't going to go and tell their parents?
We have some very exciting news this week.
This is a world exclusive.
Dolly and I have been beavering away behind the scenes with a brand new sponsor. This is our biggest brand alignment yet, and it's one that we feel really proud of, don't we? Because it's kind of a dream for us, actually.
And also, like, genuinely is one of our favourite brands, full stop.
Which is so great, because it's not like we have to sit here being like, we love Foot Locker.
Yeah, Squatty Potty. That's what all the American podcasts do, and they're going on about, like, now I actually know how to expel waste.
Anyway, so we are so excited to announce our new sponsor. We are now working with NARS, the makeup brand that Dolly and I have loved ever since we could afford proper slap, which gives us a legit excuse to dedicate a segment each episode to all things NARS. I wanted to kick off our sponsorship with Radiant Creamy Concealer because it is my number one desert island product. It's my hero product, in fact, something I cannot leave the house without, even when I'm wearing no other makeup. And it introduced me to NARS. It reeled me in, you could say. I actually get nervous if I don't have creamy concealer on me. Even more excitingly, so it already comes in a square tube, and it now has a new sibling in a little pot, the Soft Matte Complete Concealer, which is kind of slightly waxier, more durable coverage. It launched early this year, and it's the only thing I'm wearing on my face right now, and it's just brilliant whenever you have a nicely timed bout of summer acne. Sackney. Both Radiant Creamy and Soft Matte Complete Concealer ring in at £23.
Also, can I say something about creamy concealer? I have very dry skin, and it's the only concealer that doesn't make me scaly like a lizard.
Yes, yeah, sorry for not asking your opinion earlier. Since we last met, Prince William's cover interview with GQ magazine has come out. I was amazed to rip open Ollie's GQ subscription. I don't wait for him to do it himself. To see that Prince William was on the cover. He's been interviewed by Alistair Campbell, who does the magazine's kind of big, you know, it's like the big Alistair Campbell interview.
Is it the Alistair Campbell?
Yeah. Blair's former spin doctor is the interviewer, and he's actually brilliant. He's a bloody good interviewer. So whatever your feelings on him, maybe, or even the questions he asks, he's very, very good. So I was really surprised to see that Prince William had agreed to an interview with him, because Alistair is a staunch Republican. So I thought that was pretty cool. And William obviously did the interview as kind of his leg of publicity to promote the mental health charity that him, Catherine and Harry are ambassadors for, called Heads Together. I think it's a sort of tit for tat in that Harry famously did to great aplomb Briony Gordon's podcast. So there are some excerpts online, although I strongly advise you to buy the magazine, because the best bits are in the magazine. He talks about a lot of things. He talks about mental health. He talks about the experience of his mother dying as a teenager and the subsequent grief. He talks about how he deals with his role of celebrity and how it differs from his mother's treatment of the media.
That's very interesting, I think, his thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm just going to read you a little excerpt. Alistair Campbell, he does not pander to him, he does not pull any punches. He asks about Princess Diana, and William says, "The complete salacious appetite for anything at all about her, even if there was no truth in it whatsoever." And Alistair Campbell goes, "So you don't have any sympathy with the argument that she cultivated her friends in the media and fed them the whole thing?" And he says, "I have been exploring this. Remember, I was young at the time. I didn't know what was going on. I knew some games and shenanigans were played. But she was isolated. She was lonely. Things within her own life got very difficult. She found it hard to get her side of the story across. I think she was possibly naive. She ended up playing into the hands of some bad people. This was a young woman with a high-profile position, very vulnerable, desperate to protect herself and her children. I feel strongly that there was no responsibility taken by media executives who should have stepped in and said, 'Morally, what are we doing? Is this right? Is this fair? Is this moral?' Harry and I were so young, and if she'd lived..." This is heartbreaking. "I think if she had lived when we were older, we'd have played that role. I feel very sad and very angry that we were not old enough to be able to do more to protect her. Not wise enough to step in and to do something that could have made things better. I think that a lot of people should have been held to account for that." So he absolutely steps back and sees his mother, not just as his mother, but
as a whole, flawed, vulnerable human
being.
And
he admits that her relationship with the media was a problematic one, and that they couldn't just be... It wasn't just all on them. And it's actually really interesting, because I've been reading the Diana Chronicles by Tina Brown. Now, Tina Brown is a journalist whom the Hilo is named in tribute to. She coined the term Hilo journalism in the 80s. And Tina Brown was just like an absolute kind of wunderkind, or however you say that word, wunderkind. She edited Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. She edited Tatler, age 25. Anyway, it's the 20th anniversary of the Diana Chronicles. So they've been re-released with a foreword by the broadcaster, Andrew Marr. And I just wanted to read you again a little bit about what he said about Princess Diana, because I was, I think, 9 when Princess Diana died. So it's...
She died on my birthday.
Did she?
Yeah.
It's not a culture of celebrity that we lived through. So it's only reading this book that I am absolutely plunged, and oh my God, you're going to love it, darling, plunged into like 80s slowny pony political Britain. And it's just absolutely brilliant. So he writes here, "The newspapers..." This is when Diana, you know, became princess. "The newspapers were much more powerful, well before the forced closure of the News of the World. If anything epitomised this last hurrah, it was Diana's tumultuous love affair with the camera and the tabloids. Briefly a victim, she was drawn into a vortex of exploitation before blossoming from puppet into puppeteer." And then there's one other bit that I thought was really great. "No fallible human should ever have been the glossy receptacle of so much panting expectation. Any real person subjected to the hot adoration of her tens of millions and the frantic insistence that you understand me would melt into a puddle of exhaustion or a cloud of hysterical laughter. Some of what happened was the fault of the public. We treated her as a Botticelli heroine, as a painted representation of ideal womanhood." And that's something that William says as well, that when him and Harry were walking behind her coffin, and Alistair kind of really like prods him, he says, "I don't know how you didn't cry. I would cry if I was walking after my mother." And William said, "You have no idea what it was like with people baying, you know, sobbing hysterical tears for my mother, and she was my mum.
Who they didn't know.
Yeah. It's anyway, both the interview and the book are absolutely amazing.
I think it's interesting because I have always, and I've been guilty of doing this, I've always thought of Prince William and Kate Middleton particularly as those two members of the royal family to be a bit bland and to kind of hold themselves back and not give much of themselves to the public. And I think that's because I don't really understand that vortex, that Diana vortex that you talked about. You know, an editor that Pandora and I both worked under, Jackie, said that when she worked at the Daily Mail for years and years and years, she said all that coloured that time, she said every day, Diana, Diana, Diana.
Well, that's
Diana.
Why it's called the Diana Chronicles.
Yeah, and she, and I think that we don't understand what that must have been. And I think when you read more and more about it, and when you think about the fact that many people do believe that she died at the hand of the media because of a exploitative but also consensual toxic relationship, some believe that, you do understand the reticence of young royals now. And you do understand in a post-Diana world why Prince William and Kate Middleton behave the way that they do. And I think he sounds like a very intelligent, sensitive, compassionate and grounded person.
He addresses, and do you know what, whatever faults Prince Charles has with all of his mad letters to Parliament, they've obviously been brought up well by him. You, regardless of whether you're a royalist or Republican, I don't think you can, when you see them doing their various charitable deeds, and they do, they have a full-time job as the ambassadors of the charities they work for, you know, they have a genuine charm. But that he, William talks about what you were saying a little bit in the interview, where he says, I am an incredibly private person, and I am sort of as private because I saw what happened with my mother, and Catherine and I want to bring up our children in a completely different way. We don't want to bring them up in a bubble. We want them to be able to experience real life. So we have to have this kind of, he doesn't say it, but it's what's implicit, is we have to have this quite dull but cordial relationship with the media, because we want our children to, you know, I mean, they're always going to have security. They're never going to be safe, want of a better word. But what is very interesting in the book as well, something else that I think we forget, is that she was so young.
Oh, she's a baby.
She was 19 when kind of her and Charles first met, and he was 31, a confirmed bachelor. And what is really interesting that you learn through the book is not only did he never stop his love affair with Camilla, it happened before either of them got married. Her and her husband cheated on each other rampantly, we learn. They had an open relationship. So her relationship with Charles never, ever, ever stopped. From this book, suggests. And
but also
Diana,
from many interviews, that famous Martin Bashir interview.
Yes, I know, because those excerpts are amazing. But what's really interesting is that Tina posits, Or says, kind of, she doesn't pull any punches. She's not rude, but she doesn't pull any punches. Tina posits that Diana knew this, but she knew what she wanted. She wanted Charles as her husband. And she was not without complications. And it's just a very human and unbelievably well, rigorously researched. You know, she interviewed over 250 people for that book.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so it's been recently re-released with an Andrew Marr foreword that I saw was in the Telegraph a few weekends ago, actually, as an article on its own. And I really suggest reading it, just only because also it makes you realise that, not makes you realise, but, you know, the royal family are humans too. And both Diana and Charles did not really grow up with parents in situ. They were both through different mediums, fairly. Diana's mother was kicked out of her own house by Diana's father. You know, she saw Frances Shand kid, she's called. She saw her once a year from the age of sort of six. She never came home again. So, you know, the tough times in these aristocratic families and a lot of parental neglect.
When Pandora told me she was reading this, immediately I said to her, you've got to watch this Keith Allen documentary.
As in Lily Allen's father.
Lily Allen's father made this completely insane documentary, which was showed at Cannes, I think. And every time it's to be watched available online in England, immediately it's taken down. It's like illegal to watch it here. That basically is like this bonkers, conspiratorial, but very convincing documentary that literally proves, he says, that Prince Philip killed Princess Diana.
It reminds me of when BuzzFeed circulated about a year ago this unbelievably persuasive conspiracy theory that Louis from One Direction actually hadn't had a baby and it was a doll, and they showed all the ways that the doll had been photoshopped, and obviously a year later you can see him carrying his baby out and about, but you read it and by the end you were convinced that, you know, no one was actually human because they'd done this amazing, you could see it sort of through the ages.
You should try and track down this Keith Allen thing if you can though. It's hard. It will be a hard treasure hunt to find it online, but it's worth it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There is a new anthem and video for the body positivity movement. Miss Eves, the singer known as Shantani Exum, has released a new song from her upcoming album Feminasty called Thunder Thighs. It is a celebratory and joyful, cellulite-loving, witty ode in favour of chub rub, thick thighs and thunder thighs. And it's already had hundreds and thousands of views, and lots of women have said it's their summer anthem.
So I watched the video. It's not my kind of catchy tune, I have to be honest. There's been a lot of commentary around it. I would implore you to watch the video because I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, it's one of those things in pop culture that's definitely being watched a lot, not necessarily because the song is amazing, but because of the kind of intent and the commentary around it. So Jezebel calls Thunder Thighs the feel-good video of the summer, and they interviewed the Brooklyn-based Miss Eves about her album. She said that Feminasty is an exploration of my feminist feelings and sexuality, covering themes like female masturbation, men telling me to smile, Tinder fuck buddies, and shaking off internet trolls. But what was really interesting underneath, and I think this really encompasses the full weight, pun sort of intended, of the debate, were the comments. And I just wanted to read out a few because I imagine they will kind of mirror a lot of the reactions that people will have to the video and to this kind of idea of body positivity and what it means now. So comment one, I sure wish we'd had this stuff back in the 80s. When I was a teen, there was one message and that was thighs must not touch, otherwise you are subhuman. Comment two, are there any members of the Jezebel community that don't agree with body positivity when it's glamorising women that are so clearly overweight that they're destined for health problems? Or are you guys behind being proud and confident as we dance our fat asses into the morgue? No doubt, some of the women in that video, while fat, are still at a fairly healthy weight. And I'm happy to see more of this diversity in the media. But I'm concerned that young, impressionable kids are going to feel like this gives them carte blanche to clog their arteries, get diabetes and destroy the aesthetic integrity of our public places. Comment three, I sometimes struggle with comprehending the more radical fat is beautiful campaigning because it often strikes me as futile. It is not just fat, it is anything that contradicts the body norm, like a set of crooked teeth like mine. Even if fashion and magazine industries co-opt these things, it will just be a passing fad on an otherwise perfect body like a model with vitiligo. I think comment three is probably talking about the model Winnie Harlow right there. I'm really interested by this comment, particularly the last one, because I think we do often see models or public figures fetishized for their point of difference, and you just know that it's not going to last. It immediately made me think of this trans model, Andre Pejic, who 3 years ago or so was like the model of the year, you know, booked left, right and centre, until he lost, in inverted commas, his point of difference, and he fully transitioned into a woman and became Andrea Pejic. And it was like his USP had gone, and I hardly see Andrea modelling anywhere now.
I think that's a really very good point. And I think you do have to ask whether they're being fetishised and celebrated and held up for their true beauty. For both of those cases that you mentioned is abundant, or whether it's for brands to garner favour with completely temporary diversification and phony virtue signalling. But then a part of me is like, does it even matter? Does the ethos, obviously I don't want people to be discarded, but in terms of seeing them on campaigns and on catwalks, does it matter what the ethos and machinations is of those of the people that are still trying to sell a product? It's still normalizing their beauty, which is perhaps something to be joyful about. I don't know.
I definitely believe in platforming. I think we should see representations. What I find slightly more problematic with videos like Thunder Thighs, or when Meghan Trainor did that video all about that base, you know, and she talks about skinny bitches or something, or like thin mean girls. There's something in that that I remember when that came out also had a lot of controversy, which was... is the message here that there's one body type that's right and one that's wrong, one that's nice and one that's mean, kind of thing. And what I just find slightly problematic with this is that I agree with platforming, but sometimes the narrative around it, I feel, as you say, can be disingenuous. Yes. Just, you know, like, oh, let's diversify the platform. I don't think this is disingenuous at all, but I do find the whole idea of owning something rather than accepting it really problematic. Sometimes I think that in this kind of drive to be diverse and more PC, we end up with this quite kind of crass way of trying to pretend that we love everything ugly about ourselves. You know, like when you see those like really awful adverts where it's like, I love myself for my faults. And it's like, but do you? Do you love yourself for your faults? So I kind of find that the idea of owning something rather than just accepting it problematic. So I own my cellulite. I have it on my thighs, and my bum when I clench looks like cottage cheese. I own it by dint of it being on my own body. But do I own it in that kind of righteous girlfriend way? No, I don't. And I don't think that should be seen as unfeminist for me to say, I wish I didn't have cellulite. I would prefer not to have cellulite. But I do have it, and I accept that I have it, but I don't necessarily see why I should have to try and make that one of the best things about me. And does that make me non-body positive?
Well, I think what you're saying, which I agree with, is we mustn't demonise these. We only think it's a flaw because society has told us it's a flaw, so that's why we shouldn't demonise ourselves. But we also don't have to be defined by it. And I think
that's the word I was looking for when I was like trying not to fall into a hole where I was going to get people shouting at me.
No, but I completely understand,
you know,
what you're
where
saying.
It's the accepting and kind of owning.
Yes, and I think, you know, I have two thoughts about body positivity. The first is that it is a wonderful and helpful thing. We only ever really see and have only seen one type of body for a long time. We see it everywhere. It makes women believe that their body is made wrong. It makes women feel ashamed of their body. It makes women feel negatively about their body. And then, you know, bodies become a preoccupation and they don't want to exercise or have sex or dance or be in the workplace. It ruins confidence and cuts off experiences of life. And also it can make, as we know, women go for very dangerous measures to try and emulate this body they see everywhere. When really we should just be grateful and in tune and listening to our bodies, whoever we are, male or female, because they are the vehicle that carries us through life, and they take us on travels and adventures, and they can self-heal and they self-regenerate, and you can make babies and make love with that. You know, it's a wonderful thing to celebrate them. But on the other hand, there's the Helen Nianis theory, which is... So Helen Nianis is a journalist.
I love that. Everyone's going to be like, what's that theory? I never studied that in physics.
Now, Helen said this once, and I always borrow this theory because it really struck a chord with me, where she said women are still... It's still the other end of the spectrum where women are still obsessing and being defined by their physical being.
That's the thing. And you're still defining. You're just defining a different body type.
Yeah.
It's still putting the emphasis on a bum. It's
exactly, just... exactly. And she said, you know, I feel like we know so many women, you know, me included, as a size 12 woman, we know so many women who've had to come out and have an opinion on their boobs or their stomach or their cellulite or their, you know, they've got to have some sort of relationship with it. And she said, how many chubby blokes do you know? And I think we all know a lot of chubby blokes. And she said, how many of them have you ever heard in the pub or coming out in a magazine saying that they feel they have some oneness with their, you know, beer belly, that they have some sort of love affair with their, you know, big wobbly thighs? They don't have to, because that's embarrassing and infantilizing, and they just don't need to. And I think I'm all for body positivity, but I also hope that we won't need it for the long-term future. I'm hoping that our great-great-granddaughters won't have to come out and have any opinion at all on bits of their body, whether they love them or hate them.
They can just inhabit.
They can just inhabit it, and their body is just there by dint of them existing.
Maybe we won't have bodies anymore.
Ooh!
There's this kind of ghastly named subtext. I feel like you're going to hate the name of this, Dolly, called body posy bloggers.
Oh yeah, I know.
So
them,
I hate the word posy for positive. So body posy bloggers. So at the moment there's this drive to reclaim your stomach outline. So I read this article on Teen Vogue, where it's basically encouraging people to wear clothes that show off their belly bulge, for want of a better word. And it's a trend on Instagram as well. And it's just this idea that you like frame your, you know, the softness. You know how you have that kind of softness in your belly? Mm. It's to frame the softness of the belly, not to hide it. Like, it's like the anti-Spanx. I don't know if I believe in it necessarily, and I don't think it's any healthier than framing a flat gym-honed stomach. Both of these attitudes, whether or not you're showing off your abs saying I did this in just 6 weeks, or you're showing off your belly bulge saying this is me and, you know, I'm proud of this or whatever, it's both are great for you for going to a gym, great for you for being proud of your, sorry, I can't believe I keep saying belly bulge, but I can't think of any way to say it. But both of them fetishize an area that is typically problematic on women. I mean, hello, president of Babes Who Blow speaking right now. Both attitudes, I think, give off this air of doing something really altruistic, like I'm doing this for you guys, I'm letting you know that you can feel XYZ about your stomach. But ultimately it's still focusing on this body part rather than leaving it to just be, and there's just too much kind of obsessing wholesale. And I'm really sorry, I don't see belly framing taking off. Like, I hate the idea of a beach body, and I thought it was great when Sadiq Khan pulled Protein World's ad last summer, or was it the summer before, where she's in that yellow bikini and it's like, get beach body ready. Yeah. I think that's great, because who wants to stare at that at 8 a.m. when they haven't even had a coffee? But I actually don't think that it's inherently evil. I think that if you want to get beach body ready, you shouldn't feel ashamed of getting beach body ready. And if you have a belly bulge and don't want to get beach body ready, you shouldn't feel ashamed of that either. But I don't know why we have to come out and it seems like you're either like Fitspo or you're body posy. And I'm not going to be doing either.
I think it's, the problem is that there's such a discrepancy between an encouragement of getting beach body ready and an encouragement of accepting belly bulge, which is now this weird shorthand we've given it. So I understand why it exists now, and I think it's important to exist now. And I think when I was a teenager, if I'd seen those pictures online, I would have found it very comforting and very cheering and would have made me feel much better about myself. So I think that's wonderful. But I really hope that this isn't the world forever. That I hope this is a short-term solution.
I think what I
to kind of to alter public consciousness.
I think what I slightly struggle with as well is that the reason why I don't see it taking off is because I don't see what's aspirational about it. It's relatable, but it's not aspirational. The idea of getting like I never do it, but the idea of going to the gym and feeling fit and healthy when you're in a bikini is, you can see the aspiration in that. The relatability of a belly bulge is you know, it cannot be argued. Of course it is. But the reason why I think I find it a bit trite or crass or disingenuous is because I don't really believe that it's something to aspire to.
I think it's
something to be okay with.
I think it's aspirational to accept and love your body, and I think 90% of women I
that's
know
true.
don't. I think 90% of women I know have
that's true. Maybe,
10 things
maybe,
they would
yeah,
change.
Maybe that's me looking at it a different way then. You're right, it is aspirational to love your body. I don't think a belly bulge is aspirational. But
I understand what you're saying. So they're trying to promote acceptance of your body. The way that they're doing
it is by picking apart the body.
Exactly, is by emulating the exact way that people advertise and fetishize very thin body. Look, it's a complicated issue.
It's a complicated issue. And if seriously, one thing I do want to add though, and I think it's interesting that we were talking about privilege earlier and me saying that I read that thing on Instagram saying privilege is when you don't see something as a problem, is that even though I might be a size 8 person myself, and I think I have a pretty good understanding of different body types because there's a real smorgasbord of body types in my family, I am not looking at these body posy bloggers as someone that really desperately needs a body posy blogger in their life. Mm. So whilst I can see something as maybe crass or trite or not aspirational, I understand that for someone else it might be the most aspirational thing of all. I just wonder if it has legs, and I wonder if it is the answer we have all been waiting for.
It certainly has thighs. This episode has taken longer than usual because of the cacophony of building sounds that you have enjoyed throughout the episode. So we've run out of time for Ask the Hilo this week. So we've just got one quick question, and then we promise a much meatier segment next week, because we've loved your questions and you've sent some really, really very well thought out and poignant ones in the last couple of weeks, and we've really loved reading all of them. You can email us at thehiloshow@gmail.com.
Or tweet us, The Hilo Show. On Twitter.
So, hi Dolly and Pandora. I love the show and always take on board your reading recommendations. I recently finished Future Sex and I've just started Difficult Women. I wondered, with your busy lives, how you both find time to read as much literature as you do. In this 24-hour, 7 days a week world of content, I sometimes find myself a little overwhelmed by how much there is to consume. How do you then balance online and offline reading? And also, do you both have favourite reading spots? Dolly, is yours Hampstead Heath? Keep up the amazing work, Jenny.
I love that idea of 24/7 world of content. That's so true.
Very true.
Well, in all honesty, I manage it by kicking other stuff out of your life. So I put my phone on airplane a lot now.
You've taught me to do that.
Yeah, I typically put it on airplane. If I'm having a night in, I put it on airplane from 9 p.m. and I don't turn it on until, I don't know, it depends when I'm at my desk, 8 a.m, 9 a.m, 10 a.m. I also put it on airplane for about 6 hours every Sunday. I put it on airplane as much as I physically can. I also take a book in my handbag, so when I'm on the tube, instead of like idly wondering what profession that person has or who that person's married to or, I don't know, what leg that guy hangs down, I read my book instead. And I go out less than I used to. I really made a conscious decision that I did not want to be out ideally more than 3 nights a week, so reading is now
a priority
part of my life. Yeah, what about you? What are your...
I agree with everything you've just said. I think that not trying to multitask is the best way of getting through books properly and really focusing on something and getting lost in a narrative or a voice. So I have to have my phone completely out of my room if I'm reading now. You've taught me to put my phone on airplane mode, which I think is good because it also means that none of your messages can even come through to you. So it just, no, everyone knows that you're just not contactable for that time. I also do, as you said, I never get on a train. I never leave the house without a book in my bag.
I checked mine in at like this fancy work dinner the other day, and someone was like, "Why are you checking your book?" And I was like, "Because it came with me, duh."
Yeah,
it was like my evening clutch.
Yeah, that's what I do. I read an interview with Clarissa Dixon Wright where she said, "I never trust anyone who doesn't have a book with them at all times."
It means I don't trust my husband.
But it's true, because life, there are so many accidental pauses in life where you end up waiting for a bus or sitting in a doctor's waiting room, whatever, and then you can like easily just nail a chapter. And that's the only way that I get through the books that I want to get through, is I just have it with me at all times.
We have something very exciting happening next week as well. We are introducing a new monthly author segment where an author who we love, who has a new book out, is going to come and talk a little bit about their book and join in with the general conversation. So it is launching next week. We have the author Rennie Edo Lodge coming on to talk about her incendiary read. Thank you so much for everyone that listened to this episode, and thank you to Acast for letting us use your studio today. Don't forget to email us at thehiloshow@gmail.com or tweet us at thehiloshow. We will be back with a new episode next Wednesday.
Please remember to review us, rate us, subscribe. It gives us a huge boost and we will love you forever. We will see you again next week. Goodbye.